Get ready to wade through the flotsam and jetsam of words that have lost all their meaning to us, except in very specific circumstances. So batten down the hatches. We wouldn't want to give this topic short shrift. Join us as we dig up some fossil words on the latest You're Saying It Wrong podcast. Find it at KMUW.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Marginalia, a production of KMUW Wichita.
Marginalia. Notes in the margin of a book.
Notes, commentary, and similar material written in the margin of a book.
Comments and notes which are incidental
or additional to
the main topic in the margin of a book.
Melanie Finn's literary thriller, The Hair, considers a woman's inherent sense of obligation, sexual and emotional, to the male hierarchy. I recently spoke with Finn about how her own experience parallels her protagonist's and about how one learns that actions have consequences. I'm Beth Golay, this is Marginalia, and here's our conversation. Okay, so The Hair, the story begins in 1983, and I'm wondering if you wouldn't mind setting it up for us. Tell us, you know, who we meet, where they're located, kind of give us a little bit of background, if you would.
Right. So Rosie Monroe is a young, clueless woman, as probably most of us who are women have been. And she has struggled growing up with a distant grandmother and some abuse that she suffered. And she gets a scholarship to study art at Parsons School of Design in New York. She's somewhat adrift there, and in the Museum of Modern Art one morning, she meets Bennett Kinney, a man who's 20 years older than her, very sophisticated and charming. And Bennett kind of seduces her, and Rosie ends up moving with him to an estate on the Connecticut Gold Coast. Bennett becomes a teacher, I guess, in many ways, trying to teach her about social mores and books and sex. And so initially there's this idea that he's kind of like a mentor, but that darkens. And we begin to glimpse, I think, ahead of Rosie on this, that Bennett is actually not a very scrupulous person. He ends up moving Rosie and their young daughter in the middle of the night to an abandoned farmhouse in northern Vermont, where he then kind of abandons them again for a job that may or may not exist at an elite college. Things kind of turn worse at that point. Rosie has to figure out how to live in this really unwelcoming landscape where it's very cold and she has no resources, no food, no money, and a wood stove that she doesn't know how to use. And Bennett becomes increasingly elusive and even malevolent. So that's the sort of the setup of the book from about 1983 until I think when the book really goes to a different pitch.
You know, a friend of mine said that you should excommunicate anyone who contains or cheapens this book by calling it a literary thriller, because it's leaps and bounds above that genre, and in that it subtly tackles so many issues: class, patriarchy, gender, motherhood, sexual orientation, abortion, sexual abuse. You know, this was a book of extremes for me. It was stunningly beautiful writing about some horrible subjects. Were you conflicted at all with the stark contrasts in when you were writing it?
I think, and if you remember, there's a whole dialogue around the words "I think" that women tend to preface their sentences with.
That's right.
I catch myself doing that all the time now. This was a really, really personal book for me. I came to realize a few years ago that I tend to not write about places until I've left them, and so not only having left, as it were, my own childhood abuse, but also I think having left society's idea of femininity and motherhood as I entered menopause, I really felt I could write about this from an objective point of view. So while it was deeply personal, I also felt I was looking back on it through a lens that I did not have the ability to do that while I was inside all that emotional turmoil and trying to figure things out. So I can simply say that menopause is a great thing if you get to make it there.
You know, you say you don't write about things until after you've left them. And I'm assuming you're still in Vermont, right?
I am.
Now,
that's a good observation. I am still in Vermont, and I have been solidly in Vermont now for 2 years. I have not even barely been into New Hampshire, which is about 15 miles from here. So,
you know, on your website, you wrote that your book, The Underneath, which was published in 2018, became a cipher for your own struggles as a mother, living often in isolation on your Vermont homestead. And part of The Hair takes place in an isolated region of Vermont as well. And I found this one descriptor in the book very telling. Mud is its own season in Vermont. It is no simple transition. So talk to me about your home and how it influences your writing.
We do live in a remote area, and it is called Kirby, so Kirby does exist, although the Kirby in The Hair, and in fact the Kirby in The Underneath, are more places in my imagination. We live on a big piece of land, which, saying that to someone who lives in Kansas, is kind of a joke, because a lot of land here is 350 acres. And remote also is got different meanings there in Kansas. We're 20 minutes from town. So It is, we have these brutal winters here. I'm looking outside now, it's snow. We're expecting temperatures of zero this weekend. The seasons here are incredibly powerful. You know, there's nothing subtle about spring. There's nothing subtle about winter. And there's certainly nothing subtle about the incredible falls we get here. I don't think that you can live here as a writer and not be a part of the landscape and how it's shaped, how people live here and have always lived here. The harshness of the seasons are very, very, have a huge impact on us. Even if we're not working outside, simply getting out and starting your car is, for 5 months of the year, you know, is it going to start? Is it covered in frozen ice? Having said that, I don't think that that's that different to some of the weather I know that you experienced there in Kansas.
You know, I've never been to Vermont, yet I feel like I have. I could feel the cold. I just felt like I was there. You painted such a vivid picture for me. And so I just really wanted to, I don't even have a question there. I just wanted to remark on it. I feel like I've been to Vermont. Okay, I want to talk about gender roles. So at one point in your book, you wrote, and this is a quote, "She did what women do and have always done, because the laundry still needs to be folded, the children collected from school or the fields or the workhouse, the dinner has to be made or gathered or harvested or butchered. Women do what needs to be done. They do what is expected, the obligation of their gender." Now, Rosie was protecting her young daughter when these words appeared in the book, but I wanted to talk to you about how this applies to gender roles. Can you just talk to me about what you were thinking when you wrote that?
I think, there we go again.
No, I asked you, I set you up for that one.
Right. So I'm 55, I think I might be 56, I can't remember. There's a big difference for people of my educational background now as women than there was when I was a child or my mother was a child. And I watch my daughters who are now 11, I didn't have them until I was 45. So I'm seeing feminism from a different perspective as they're seeing feminism. My experience of the oppression of my gender, which was, I think, amplified by the fact that I was abused and didn't have support growing up and didn't have a mother who really had been allowed to have her own ambitions or encouraged to see herself as being a worthwhile individual. My children, on the other hand, you know, have me really supporting them and being involved in their lives. And they're surrounded now by a culture that is very supportive of girls in sports and girls becoming doctors and girls going to the moon and back. That was just not how it was when I grew up. And I was very much in the shadow of my mother's experience of basically being, you know, sort of passed on to just simply marry the richest man you can because that's what you do in life.
You know, as you're speaking, I was I was thinking about the other women who were in Rosie's life, her grandmother. And I, as you were speaking, I was wondering if, you know, that age disparity prevented her from protecting Rosie. And then I was thinking of Billy, who I'm not even sure if there was an age difference there. But just, you know, the different women in Rosie's life made such a stark, there was such a difference in how they could support her and how they could be.
They're all trying to squeeze themselves, or they're all trying to understand how to be women in the world. So you have Rosie's grandmother, who is struggling financially. And obviously, as we talked about, the poverty in this book is really key. So you have this grandmother who's bereft. She's lost her beloved son, and she's got this grandchild who she really doesn't know what to do with. She's struggling to understand how she should be a female figure in this young girl's life, and she fails completely. Then you have Billy, who, not to give too much away, is a woman, but has kind of rejected femininity as her own means of survival. And I think that it's difficult to write a feminist book without trying to, you know, just knock on men and be like, oh, all men are bad, because clearly they're not. And I'm not writing about men. In this case, I'm really trying to understand what it means to be a woman in this world and how you figure that out and how you own your own skin when you live in a culture that bombards you with how you're supposed to look and what you're supposed to do and how you're supposed to speak and who you're supposed to marry. We are moving through this amphitheater of echoing noises, just telling us how we need to be. So for a woman to figure that out in herself is a lifelong task. And at the risk of trying to create archetypes rather than real characters, I would say that the strongest female characters in this book are the ones who have either figured out how they're going to go through life, or they've simply rejected, you know, any kind of female role at all.
You know, you leave the reader with a lot of unknowns. I mean, I think we know what happens at the farmhouse after Rose leaves it, but we're not around to see what happens next. And another thing that I'm curious about is we weren't there to see the shift in the relationship between Rose and her daughter. Were you striving for some ambiguity there?
I kind of think that a good book gives you enough space to figure out what's going on. I've gotten in trouble for my endings before, and that they tend to not be very on point and leave readers hanging. For me, it's not so much what the specifics of what has happened, but the authentic feeling that the character has really changed or shifted or reached a certain point. So rather than feeling that I wanted to nail down the specifics of what had happened with her relationship with Miranda, I really hope that I've achieved that in a nutshell, you understand the dynamic of that relationship. And you understand also that it's Rosie's perspective of that relationship that might be slightly different to, say, how her daughter Miranda might see the relationship.
You know, Rosie is 18 when we meet her in 1983. And Rose is 54 when we leave her in 2019. And she's basically my age. I'm 53 right now, but I really felt like I was could have been reading about myself. You know, but her transformation was, it involved more than just dropping an I from her name, didn't it?
Yes. I think
that was a dumb question.
Yeah. Yes. You mentioned that I leave big sections out of the book, and clearly one of those big sections is what happens between the Rosie with the eye and the Rose without the eye. You arrive to Rose at age 54 in a JCPenney's, you know, regarding herself naked in the mirror and just horrified by what she sees. So what has happened to her in those 20-something, 30-something intervening years? Rose, as we grow up, more self-sufficient in ourselves, and we understand ourselves better, and we understand the world better. By the time we reach Rose, she's in the middle of menopause. So this is a theme. Obviously, speaking of that country, that one has left. I'm finally over that period, that 4 or 5 years. But it was an extraordinary country to visit because it's such a time of transformation. And I wanted Rose to be in the midst of that transformation so that when we see her at the end, we realize, like, God, the risk of being corny, she has gone through that catharsis, that kind of caterpillar change. She's gone through that cocoon and she is this, you know, free butterfly. I wanted that to be the last third of the book, that, you know, she still has this change to go through, and that the freedom at the end of the book is in itself a new beginning.
So I was looking at your webpage, and you have done, you know, so much. I'm looking at the work that you've done in Africa and the filmmaking that you've done. And, you know, when we did our little test call yesterday, I think you said something about teaching skiing. Is there anything that you don't do or that you want to do?
Make money. I would really like to get better at that. I seem to be stuck in the zone of just doing tons of all this amazing stuff, and my life is so full. But, you know, when it comes to paying bills, so I think that element of the financial struggle, really, it does come through in the book. We're okay now. I know the pandemic has been really, you know, has knocked us for six, as it has many, many people financially. And certainly I recognize in myself some of Rose's real financial struggles. That said, I've always been the person who can manage to skim by on very, very little. That changes when you have kids. So most of these things that I did, making films and starting health projects, this was all happened before children. Like, having children, it nails you to a place where you just have to make a different set of decisions. Yeah. And you have a different set of outputs. I still do run the health project, feel very committed to it. We focus a lot on women's health. And I teach skiing, because if I didn't teach skiing, I would not get out of my house and I would go truly, truly insane.
You know, I've asked a few questions about the book, and I don't want to spoil it for readers who are just discovering it, but is there anything that you want to talk about that I have not asked?
Let me think about that.
Okay.
I wanted to write a book that revealed my journey through the avatar of Rosie. Obviously, I'm not Rosie, but I did suffer abuse as a child, and I think that abuse is such a long shadow that it impacts you for so many years in so many ways that you don't even recognize, because you're so inside that. It seems that you're making decisions, but now when I look back, I realize they weren't decisions at all. They were simply reactions to this sort of fundamental event that happened to me as a child. For so many women, we have had this history of abuse, whether it's happened when we were children or whether it's happened later on. I really wanted the book to reach those women, to say, it's really hard to live in this world of men. It's really hard to be a woman and figure out what that means. It's really hard to find your power when you feel so disempowered. And again, this isn't about knocking men. They're supposed to be anti-men. But to say there is this place where you can look back and you are free of it. It's not that it didn't matter or it didn't impact you, but you can actually step aside and become uncoupled from that particular burden. That is where I wanted to leave Rose, where she was absolutely uncoupled from the past, from all her mistakes and from everything that had been done to her and everything that she had done to herself. Ultimately, I wanted this to be a really uplifting book for women, and particularly women who had, you know, suffered abuse of some kind, which most women have. The numbers, as we know, are staggering. So that's what I'd like to say about my book.
Well, I thought it was absolutely amazing. I loved just how, you know, when she would trek through the snow with Miranda on her back, and she was getting physically and emotionally stronger. I just found myself cheering for her at that point.
I hope that it does really speak out to people. And I don't want it to be too much as a sort of feminist treatise, because I really didn't write it that way. And funnily enough, some of the feedback I've got is it's like, oh, it's just like this feminist evolution. You see her from this young, naive girl evolving into this, you know, knowledgeable, independent woman. And I hadn't started from that standpoint, but I can see how that's internally what happened as I took this character. I think that we overestimate how stupid we were when we were younger, like how we just didn't know what we were doing. And we're so hard on ourselves because we don't recognize how little data we were operating with a lot of the time. And then as we get older, trying to find that line between kind of being bitter and cynical, careworn, but also just really being practical and understanding of the way the world is, it's a hard thing for a person, let alone in a character. So the other thing is, I think about the book in terms of my own self, that becoming really, really physical. I moved out to Taos in the 90s and became a ski bum. And the physicality of my life there was really, really transformative, because as I became physically strong, I had this different relationship with my body. And that also happens to Rose. So you kind of go from seeing yourself as your body maybe having one purpose, which is essentially to please men, to realizing what an incredible vessel this is, what an incredible tool to allow you to be free in the environment. So definitely that part of it, you know, my personal experience comes into it for Rose when you, as you say, she's out snowshoeing, she's just becoming physically strong. And that gives her a great sense of self-worth and power.
You know, was it just the menopause talking? Why was she? And I feel like this is just me wanting to ask this question and not including it because I don't want to give it away. But why was she so angry about Chris? You know, his change, her change was like this years long menopausal change, and his had to do with money and surgery. I mean, was it just the menopause talking then?
That's a good question. So this did actually happen, and I'm okay if you end up wanting to use parts of what I say. So
okay.
It did happen that a friend who'd been a producer who I'd worked with in LA, I was speaking with him one day, and he said, well, you know, I'm becoming a woman. And I was completely shocked, because this person who I knew had really been, you know, quite masculine. And I couldn't understand wanting to become a woman when he had been an attractive, successful man. Like, it didn't make any sense. What was the, you know, what was the cost benefit analysis of becoming a woman? And she ended up sending me some photographs of herself, and in these photographs, you know, it was, had enormous breast implants and was wearing like high heels and like peekaboo glasses. And I couldn't recognize that idea of feminism or femininity. It seemed like everything that I was trying to reject, this idea of, you know, hypersexualized womanhood, was somehow what this friend of mine had chosen to adopt in becoming a woman. And I was deeply confused, and I was angry. I thought, but this isn't what being a woman is. Like, this is a man's idea of being a woman. So I sort of went on this internal journey, really trying to understand why I should be so offended by this choice that my friend made, which clearly, you know, she's an adult person and intelligent, worldly, kind. And I came to realize that, you know, she's just going on her own journey with this. And she's doing it in a way that's super sped up, because she's only just come to being a woman. So she's kind of got to go through the 40 years that I've been through to come where I am, she's now suddenly got to go through that in like 6 months to figure out that, oh, she's a 66-year-old woman now. She's not a 20-year-old babe. So I wanted to put that in the book as a way of Rosie coming to herself and realizing that her own transformation was still possible, that she sees in herself that there's somewhere else she wants to go. She doesn't want to just stay in this farmhouse being lonely and upset with her daughter, that there's another catharsis, there's another transformation for her to have. And her interaction with Christine really, really triggers this for her. It's not for us to judge how other people decide they want to live their lives. We just have to figure out how we're going to live ours.
So what is next for you?
Well, I am working on a fascinating project in Kenya, actually, a thriller I should back up. That's a script that I'm working on with a Tanzanian writer and a London-based producer. So hopefully that will go somewhere, because Lord knows I've been writing this script for the last 10 years. So who knows? Maybe it's finally going to go. And I'm actually just starting another book about a young girl on the edge of womanhood. I thought it would be kind of interesting to juxtapose the two, particularly as I see my own children who are now 11, and they're kind of entering the cattle chute of womanhood from one end as I exit it from the other. So it's an interesting reflection. So my next book is going to be about a told from the perspective of an 11-year-old about her mother's dissolving marriage, which is not happening to me. My marriage is fine. And her friendship with a young boy through the summer in a lake north of here. And they discover this witch hole where a long time ago people used to believe that witches lived. So it sort of references back to the whole idea of what witches are and why people are afraid of witches. So it's a little bit of a ghost story, but somewhat of a feminist book, but told from the other perspective of an 11-year-old. So, but I haven't started, although I'm supposed to have started 6 months ago.
There we go. I can't wait to read it. Well, Melanie Finn, the book is The Hair. Thank you so much for visiting with me today.
Beth, thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Absolutely. That was Melanie Finn, author of the book, The Hair, which was published by $2 Radio. Thanks for joining us for Marginalia. If you enjoyed this podcast, please leave us a review. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editor is Luann Stevens, and I am the producer. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.